It's Encounter on the Voice of America. Encounter on the Voice of America brings together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. With today's guests and the topic for Encounter, here is Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Spotlight on the Political and Humanitarian Crises in South Sudan and the Central African Republic. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Who would have thought that barely 3 years after gaining its hard-won independence, South Sudan would devolve into civil war, that the world's newest nation would be facing a humanitarian disaster of appalling proportions. According to the U.S. Agency for International Development, since the start of the conflict in late 2013, more than 1 million people have been forced from their homes, including 800,000 people who are internally displaced and some 280,000 who have fled to neighboring countries like Uganda, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Kenya. Millions more are already at risk of severe food insecurity. Indicators reveal that South Sudan may be on the brink of famine. As the rainy season looms, UN agencies and humanitarian partners warn that heavy rains and flooding could put a serious strain on their operations and further limit their access to people in need. Meantime, diplomatic efforts at resolving the political and military standoff between the government of South Sudan, led by Salva Kiir, and his adversary and former deputy, Riek Machar, have stalled. And then there's the crisis in the Central African Republic. Once again, we have a weak state and a power struggle which has devolved into a bloody conflict with sectarian overtones. Fighting erupted last March 2013 when a coalition of Muslim rebels, calling themselves Seleka, seized the capital Bangui, ousting the president. That prompted reprisals from bands of predominantly Christian militants known as the Anti-Balaka or Anti-Machete. Attacks and counterattacks by both groups in a country with little history of religious conflict has morphed into a full-scale civil war, prompting the UN Security Council to approve a peacekeeping force of 12,000 troops and police. However, the mandate for the peacekeeping force, known as MINUSCA, does not start until September 2014. The country is divided. Muslims are effectively separated from Christians. Tens of thousands of Muslims have already fled their homes in the capital and the western half of the country, following attacks by Christian militias. According to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, more than 70,000 people are crammed into horrendous conditions on the airport grounds. Even though they have the protection of international troops, they are exposed to disease, malnutrition, and untold horrors beyond the gates. The conflict is also creating groups of refugees that could be a recruiting ground for extremist groups such as Boko Haram in the decades to come. The outbreak of violence in CAR has resurrected the memory of the UN's failure to stem massacres in Rwanda, this as the world marks the 20th anniversary of that genocide. Well, for more on the crisis in South Sudan and CAR, we turn to two distinguished analysts. J. Peter Pham, he's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, that's a policy group based in Washington, and John Temin, he's director of the United States Institute of Peace Africa Programs, focusing on helping to end Sudan, South Sudan, and Somalia's multiple conflicts and prevent violence. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
Well, let me begin with you, John Temin, talking about the conflict in South Sudan. The conflict broke out last year between President Salva Kiir and his deputy, Riek Machar. Notwithstanding the many unresolved problems in South Sudan, John, briefly tell us why this dispute or power struggle escalated to all-out military conflict rather than being resolved politically.
So this started on December 15th of last year when there was a meeting of one of the senior decision-making bodies within the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the dominant political party, the SPLM. And it's a little bit unclear what happened at the conclusion of that meeting on the 15th, but the fighting started very quickly thereafter in the capital city, Juba. And there was horrific fighting and targeted killing in Juba on those next few days. And then it spread out through the countryside, primarily in the northeastern part of the country. The roots of this go way back before December 15th, though. As you alluded to, this started at least as a real political conflict between the president, Salva Kiir, and his former deputy, Riek Machar. Salva Kiir had removed Riek Machar from the vice president position last summer. Riek has always been clear about his presidential aspirations and was not seeing a path politically to the presidency. So it started as that political conflict, and Salva Kiir accused Riek Machar of trying to stage a coup attempt around that December 15th meeting. Whether that is the reality still remains to be seen. But what started as political very quickly has become ethnic, because those two protagonists are from the two largest ethnic groups. Salva Kiir is a Dinka, that's the largest ethnic group. Riek Machar is a Nuer, that's the second largest ethnic group. Those two groups have been in competition for a very long time. And so once it took on these ethnic overtones, things really spun out of control, and we have the situation that we have now. In addition to many of the numbers you recited, we're looking at least 10,000 who have been killed. In reality, I fear the numbers are probably much more than that.
Are you surprised that it has gotten to this point?
Sadly, no. And a lot of the people who follow South Sudan closely are also not surprised. What is perhaps surprising is the speed at which things deteriorated and the killing accelerated. But we've known that these cleavages, both political and ethnic, have been there for quite some time. I think a lot of us who have focused on these issues for some time have really hoped that it wouldn't come to this. And in hindsight, there's probably things that could have done better, but it has come to this. And in some ways, this is a worst case scenario that many of us feared.
Turning to you, Peter Pham, anything to add or subtract to what John said and how we got to this point, how it has deteriorated, and the fact that those who are working on a diplomatic solution have also stalled or hit an impasse?
I agree with everything John has said. One clarification, though, although the ethnic cleavages are very much there and very much a factor in the conflict, it is also a profoundly political crisis. So you do have people from different ethnic groups crossing the lines. For example, among those who are backing President Salva Kiir, his foreign minister is a Nuer. And on the other side, Riek Machar's side, there have been a number of prominent Dinka, including the widow of the country's founding father, John Garang, as well as leaders from other ethnic groups, the Shilluk, the Equatorians, etc. So it is a profoundly political crisis that has ethnic overtones. And as John said, and I would agree, perhaps we were being hopeful or wishful, but there were moments, perhaps in hindsight, when this might have been headed off or at least mitigated had more pressure been brought to build a system that was more politically inclusive, that wasn't a winner-take-all system, which has led to this zero-sum competition we see in this conflict.
Turning back to you, John Temin, so let's take a look at diplomatic efforts to defuse the crisis, both on the part of the regional grouping, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, as well as the United States, other international actors. Why have things taken so long? What is the status of efforts to reach a diplomatic solution?
Well, there are on and off negotiations happening in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia right now, led by IGAD. They have this sort of three-headed mediation team, an Ethiopian, a Kenyan, and a Sudanese, who are trying to forge a deal. And they did succeed in getting the two parties to agree to a cessation of hostilities a few weeks into the conflict. That cessation of hostilities was broken almost immediately and really has not gained any traction. And right now, the negotiations are sputtering and not going anywhere. I think largely because both sides of the conflict still fancy their chances on the battlefield. And there has long been this logic in Sudanese negotiations of you try to advance as much as you can on the battlefield in order to gain advantage at the negotiating table. There's also a long-standing logic in Sudan and South Sudan that you fight during the dry season and you negotiate during the rainy season. We're approaching the rainy season now, and it makes it harder to fight and harder to move around, so perhaps there's something to be optimistic about there. But fundamentally, until either side is really looking for a deal and is facing a lot of pressure internally and externally to find a deal, it's hard to see a meaningful deal happening.
Turning back to you, Peter Pham, it sounds like what John's saying is that it's not for lack of trying. The actors, whether it's IGAD or other international actors, have tried to bring the parties together, but they seem to want to try to win on the battleground and gain leverage before they go to the negotiating table. Would you also place the blame on the protagonists more so than IGAD and others?
Well, on the protagonists, I would agree with John that they are seeking to create facts on the ground that then can be consolidated in negotiations. There were two parts to the ceasefire that was signed at the beginning of this year. One part called for the cessation of hostilities. The other called for the release of a group of political detainees in Juba that had been held by the government of South Sudan. Now, the government released some of those detainees, but others they've not. And so that created a casus belli, a reason or at least an excuse for the rebel forces to continue their fighting. Of course, the government will say the rebel forces continuing their fighting broke that part of the agreement. So they both have something to blame. Also, I think the international community bears a certain responsibility as well for, although it's been trying to mediate, at the same time, it's not fully held the parties fully to account for their actions. And the Obama administration has made some steps in that direction by creating the legal authorities for sanctioning those who carry the conflict forward. But to date, we've pulled our punches, and we have been doing that, to be quite frank, for some years, making excuses or excusing things in South Sudan, including the closing of political space, things that led up to this crisis that perhaps we wouldn't have excused in other African states.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham, he's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, from whom you just heard, and John Temin, he's director of the United States Institute of Peace Africa Programs. We're talking about the political and humanitarian crises in South Sudan and soon the Central African Republic. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. And as always, we love to hear from you, so please send us your thoughts in an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to Innocent Owutu. He's an international relations lecturer in Nigeria. Well, back to you, John Temin, as we continue to talk about the crisis in South Sudan. Let's take a look briefly at the humanitarian dimension, which is really grave. The heads of major international aid agencies are calling for more support, talking about the displacement and food insecurity. How do you see the situation, and would you agree that the country is also potentially on the brink of famine?
It is grave. A lot of people are now talking about potentially 3.7 million people who might be at risk of food insecurity and possible famine as the rainy season approaches. Even before this conflict, South Sudan was one of the least developed places on earth, and accessibility during the rainy season was very difficult. Now the conflict makes it even harder. One of the consequences of the conflict is that lots of NGO and humanitarian workers left the country soon after the conflict for their own safety, and a lot of organizations evacuated. Now, some organizations have come back, and some organizations stayed throughout. But in some, the capacity is not even what it was a year ago. And so the world is trying to mobilize around this, and a lot of donors met over this past weekend to try to raise some money. The money that the UN is asking for has not nearly been met yet. One other thing to add, too, is that there's also about 70,000 people who are seeking shelter in various United Nations camps around South Sudan, two of them in Juba and a few of them in other state capitals. And they fled to those camps soon after the violence started because they didn't feel safe wherever they were. Their safety and security is a major concern. The UN is not set up to care for 70,000 people, and they've been doing a decent ad hoc job recently, but particularly as the rains start and the camps become muddy and you have increased risk of waterborne diseases and so forth, things potentially become even more dire.
Back to you, Peter Pham. The hope, of course, is that talks will resume and a diplomatic solution can be found, but first we have to deal with the humanitarian crisis. So how optimistic are you that this crisis can be dealt with, because there are so many other
competing crises on the plates of international donors, such as in Syria and also CAR, which we'll be talking about in just a moment.
Well, as much as I would hope and pray for a successful negotiation, I'm also perhaps troubled that the negotiations are set up as diplomats are wont to, with two sides balanced. The government, represented by President Salva Kiir, the so-called rebels led by Riek Machar. It's not altogether clear to me that Riek Machar fully commands his side of the table or that he could make a deal that would be binding. There are a number of other significant commanders on the rebel side who aren't necessarily being engaged, people like Gabriel Changsun, Peter Gadet, and others who control forces that are fighting on the side of the anti-government forces, but are not necessarily subservient entirely to Riek Machar. So we need to get the right people at the negotiating table. We also need to seriously engage leaders in South Sudan who represent broader constituencies. Before the violence broke out, the religious leaders of Southern Sudan were building up national reconciliation efforts that were, on a local level, showing some promise supported by Norway and other countries. And though they've been brought in kind of on cameo roles, they're not as actively engaged as perhaps they ought to be. So we need to get the right stakeholders to the negotiations if we're to hope that they are to have any real success.
Back to you, John Temin. And before we turn to CAR, one more comment on South Sudan. Where are we going? Are you concerned that the country that split off from Sudan is now on the brink of splitting up itself? I mean, how serious is the situation?
Well, I don't see South Sudan itself splitting any further, and I don't think that the violence we've seen over the last 4 months is reason to question the secession of South Sudan, because we do have to remember that 99% of South Sudanese voted to secede, and that was a real 99%. But it does raise grave questions about the future of this country, and this violence has set the country back years. And it raises a lot of questions about the state-building project. We tried to support it with very technical solutions, the international community did. And I think one of the critiques one could make in hindsight is that there wasn't enough attention paid to the political dynamics and to the ethnic dynamics that are at the root of this violence. But South Sudan has to get up on its feet one way or another. There's no alternative. But it's going to be South Sudanese who are going to do that themselves. And what is needed, and part of what Peter is alluding to in discussion about the church-driven process, is a basic dialogue amongst South Sudanese on what does it mean to be South Sudanese? What is the identity of our country? How do we want it run? And so forth. And until they're able to have that dialogue amongst themselves, it's hard to see the big picture changing in a dramatic way.
Are there groups trying to forge this type of a dialogue and consensus as we speak?
Some, and the church groups are probably best placed to do that because they are trusted locally and they have very good networks that spread into the rural parts of the country. And one of the silver linings of this crisis has been that some civil society organizations have done a good job mobilizing and articulating some solutions to get out of this and putting pressure both on the parties and on the mediation. We need a whole lot more of those voices.
All right. Well, now turning to the crisis in CAR, back to you, Peter Pham. You said at these microphones last year when we discussed the conflict that there might still be time to prevent this power struggle from devolving into Muslim versus Christian violence. And unfortunately, the worst has happened despite good efforts by Muslim and Christian clergy to minimize this aspect. In a country known for peaceful coexistence between these groups and even intermarriages, what's the state of play with regard to any kind of political solution on the horizon, as well as efforts to staunch the killings and exodus, especially by the Muslim population?
Unfortunately, the situation has grown more dire since we last visited on this topic. This is a country, roughly to give a sense of the dimension, the size of the U.S. state of Texas or of France, Belgium, and the Netherlands put together in a European context. Population of around 5 million. At this point, at least 650,000 people are internally displaced. Another 300,000 have become refugees flowing into neighboring countries. Estimates are at least 2 million, probably 2.5 million, are facing dire food insecurity. So this is a country that really has fallen and really will not rise again unless there's considerable efforts to help. Unfortunately, some of the attention that brought the intervention at the end of last year by the French forces and some African forces was also a misdiagnosis of the problem. There was a lot of talk of genocide that got the headlines, but it didn't get the right combination of forces in there. So currently in the country, there are about a little less than 6,000 African Union forces and about a little less than 2,000 French forces. Recently, the UN Security Council voted unanimously to turn this all into a UN peacekeeping mission, but the mission won't deploy until September of this year. And at which point, if you're going to deploy in September of this year, it's not a peacekeeping mission, it's a burial detail.
Very good point, a very morbid one. But quick question before you go on. Does this UN peacekeeping force augment or replace those AU and French troops?
Essentially, what will happen is that the AU troops that are there, the slightly less than 6,000, will switch their helmets for blue helmets, get a little funding from the UN, and hopefully the UN has authorized roughly 10,000 troops. So somewhere they're going to have to come up with another 4,000 troops plus 1,800 police. So it's really a rehatting and funding exercise that's going to occur. It's not an infusion of an additional 12,000 personnel, which would maybe make a dent into the problem we have.
But as you said, if indeed, using your words, this is more of a burial detail, what's going to happen in the meantime between now and then? Do you see concerted efforts and effective efforts on the ground at all?
Well, the presence of the French and African forces, primarily in the capital of Bangui, although it hasn't stopped all the violence, has at least put some sort of a lid on it. But they've not yet deployed to the rest of the country, and that's where a lot of what this low-level localized violence is taking place, where the Muslim population primarily is being victimized, not exclusively, but primarily. And there's an area where about 19,000 Muslims are entirely surrounded and isolated right now. And the French have actually raised proposals of evacuating them. I'm sort of torn on that. On one hand, you want to save their lives. On the other hand, that sort of hands those carrying out violence the victory they sought, which is to clear these people out. So it's a very difficult choice.
What is the role of Chad and other neighbors in either exacerbating the situation or perhaps trying to help diffuse this crisis?
Recently, the Chadian forces came under criticism by a number of people, both Central Africans and others, for having favored one side or the other. Primarily, the accusation was they favored the Muslim population because of ethnic and religious similarities and the fact that they had helped bring to power the Seleka movement last year. And so, kind of stung by the criticism, Chad recently decided to pull out and this past week completed its pullout officially from the Central African Republic. And the real question is now, if this chaos, this vacuum, this violence continues, some of the neighboring countries may be tempted to, if not carve out territory, certainly advance their own interests rather than leave a vacuum on their doorsteps.
Do you see that happening? What are the regional ramifications of what's going on in CAR?
Well, this is a country that borders not only Chad, but South Sudan, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of Congo, countries that all of which have their own crises of their own. So instability here will reverberate throughout the region. Now, the international community is trying to back a political process. Unfortunately, it's a political process with very, very flawed actors. Now, in international relations, we have to deal with what we have, not what we would wish for, but one would wish that the CAR would have slightly better actors. The current president, Catherine Samba Panza, was formerly the mayor of Bangui, appointed, not elected, appointed by the last warlord who seized power, Michel Chitodia. And she herself has now come under criticism, and a number of journalists have reported how she's filling the administration with relatives, former warlords, and other disreputable sorts. She presents a very nice figure to the international community, says the right things, but her record and background don't give much reason for a great deal of optimism.
Well, do you see, as we asked about South Sudan, perhaps more applicable to CAR, do you see this country splitting, whereby the bulk of the Muslim population will seek shelter elsewhere because they are the ones who are primarily victimized?
There's a danger. I don't see a great probability, but a danger. The former warlord who had seized power and been president and now is in exile, Michel Chitodia, has made statements about carving out a separate Muslim state. But this is a country really that, like South Sudan, needs this conversation about what it means to be a country. It never has had that luck. Its independence leader, Bartholomew Baganda, died shortly before independence. And since then, it's had a succession, counting the current president, of 8 heads of state. And of the 8, only 1 was elected. The rest seized power violently. State institutions were never built. The country has been plundered mercilessly. And all the resources this country has, potentially, agriculture, minerals, potentially hydrocarbons, uranium, none of which has been developed to the benefit of the people.
Well, here we have a point of convergence between South Sudan and CAR. And the last word to you, Jonathan Temin. You're an expert in conflict resolution, even if you're not an expert on CAR in particular. Based on what you've been reading and your own experience on the ground with similar conflicts, what do you think the prospects are for preventing further deterioration and trying to contain this conflict and try to build back a state which never really, as Peter Pham said, existed in the first place in a solid way?
Well, one thing I would say is that both of these countries are real tests of the African capacity to respond to these sorts of crises. And we hear a lot about African solutions to African problems. Well, this is where the rubber meets the road. And can Africa deploy its resources, its expertise, quickly enough and nimbly enough to really have an impact on these conflicts? And the jury is still out, but it's shaky right now because, as we've been discussing, these situations are getting worse, not better. But Peter is right in the similarities between these two countries in that neither has ever really had a chance to have that broad dialogue about what makes us a country, what makes us South Sudanese, what makes us Central Africans. And these two countries are far from alone on the continent in not being able to have that conversation amongst themselves. Sometimes what unites countries is sort of a common enemy or a common goal that a leadership can rally them around, but they avoid that question of what does it mean for us to be here.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, J. Peter Pham, Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and John Temin, Director of Africa Programs at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
Thanks.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was David Magnus. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Encounter on The Voice of America. Encounter on The Voice of America brought together advocates and opponents debating the critical issues of our time in a freewheeling, no-holds-barred discussion of fact and opinion. Your host was Carol Castiel. Join us again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.